Hello, everybody. Good evening. It's a great pleasure to see you all. Thanks ever so much for coming out on this cold, snowy evening. It's just inspiring, really, to see you all here. So thank you. The slide's not that good. I'm going to start with the story of one famously unreasonable reader. This is the American writer Delia Bacon, who was born in Ohio in 1811, and she was the youngest daughter of a Congregationalist minister. She's remembered now, when she's remembered at all, as the first person seriously to question who wrote Shakespeare's plays. But I'm not going to talk about that today. In the context of the theme of the lecture series on literature and emotion, I want to think a little bit about what happened to Delia Bacon when she read Shakespeare, when she encountered Shakespeare, especially the transformative effects that reading Shakespeare had upon her emotional life and her sense of who she thought she was. Bacon spent 4 years in England in the 1850s pursuing her theory that Shakespeare's books were written not by a single person, but by a group of courtiers exiled from the centre of power who were working in a determinedly proto-republican spirit. And chief among those, significantly, was Bacon's namesake, Francis Bacon. So Delia's method was to find what she called a system of philosophy in Shakespeare's lines, which she thought corresponded with Francis Bacon's. She didn't start looking out for it, but as Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote, she began to see under the surface the gleam of this hidden treasure. So truly understanding Shakespeare for Delia Bacon was all about reading. It's all about reading. It wasn't about going to the theatre and seeing Shakespeare in performance. It was all about reading. And this is what one of her students had to say about Delia Bacon. She seemed to saturate herself in Shakespeare's work, as it were, to live in it, to call into imaginative consciousness the loves, hopes, fears, ambition, disappointment, and despair of the characters, and under this intense realisation to divine, as it were, the meaning of the play. So it's intense stuff. And it was this absorption in the plays which broke Bacon, according to her friend and associate Nathaniel Hawthorne. Unquestionably, she is a monomaniac, he said. This great idea, in other words, the idea that it was Francis Bacon who lay behind the works, not Shakespeare, this great idea has completely thrown her off her balance. From her own account, it appears she did at one time lose her reason. It was on finding that the philosophy which she found under the surface of the plays was running counter to the religious doctrines in which she had been educated. So Hawthorne's remarks suggest something perhaps of what's at stake when our emotional lives are fully and directly engaged as we read. A series of intense encounters with Shakespeare involved Bacon in a sort of recalibration of all that she thought she was, as the fault lines between fiction and lived experience started to erode. Few critics have remarked upon the coincidence of names between Delia Bacon and the man that she believed lay at the heart of Shakespeare's works, Francis Bacon, and she never sought to prove a genealogical link. But searching for the origins of Shakespeare's works, Delia Bacon was also uncovering a new version of her own origins and a new version of herself. So she published her theories in 1857 in a book called The Philosophy of Shakespeare Unfolded, which is an extraordinary volume, extraordinary in all kinds of ways. But the most extraordinary thing about it, I think, is that it so vividly captures the strangeness of what happens in our imagination and in our emotional lives when we allow ourselves to become absorbed in fictional worlds, perhaps losing ourselves in the process. So for Hawthorne, This was nothing, really, but evidence of Bacon's monomania, as he called it. So that's a sort of fixed idea in the mind, in which the mind loses its reason in one particular respect, but retains its soundness in every other respect. So for Hawthorne, this was an illness for Bacon. But the savagery of his response, and it is savage, I think, the savagery of his response, and others like it, is very interesting, I think. Bacon's story is famously wild and improbable, but what interests me about it is her relinquishment of herself in the act of reading Shakespeare, together with her sense that she was somehow involved in the text's production as well as their reception. And I wonder if that sheds interesting light on reading practices that we've long since forgotten, which involve a kind of sympathy. And that's what I really want to talk to you about today, a kind of sympathy as we find ourselves encountering new versions of ourselves when we read. So for a long time, as teachers and researchers in Shakespeare and in early modern literature, we tended to talk about the early modern reading experience, what happened to people when they read in the 16th and 17th centuries, as medicinal or therapeutic. So it's something that was good for you. If you read something, it meant that it was good for you, it would fortify you. Often drawing on the idea that poetry mixes learning or instruction with delight or pleasure. And that idea comes from Horace's handbook of poetry, the Ars Poetica, written around about 18 BC. So this is what Horace had to say about the function of poetry. Why do we read? What's poetry for? I'll read the translation. He wins every hand, talking about poets. So a poet would win every hand. A poet would be appreciated by everybody. He who mingles profit with pleasure by delighting and instructing the reader at the same time. So poetry might teach you something. It might instruct you. And in so doing, it would make you better, perhaps. So Horace's belief that literature can make us more morally or spiritually robust lies behind many defences of literature's usefulness and poetry's usefulness. But at the same time, as you see, poetry is delightful or pleasurable. So the instruction or the self-improvement that we gain from poetry is effective because we enjoy it, because it's pleasurable to read. And the first person to reflect in print about Shakespeare's sonnets in particular agreed with that, Francis Mears, who wrote famously in 1598 about what he called Shakespeare's sugared sonnets. So something sugary about them, something about them that's easy to swallow, easy to digest. Well, no doubt Shakespeare's sonnets were and still are tremendous fun to read, and they've given generations of readers pleasure. But at the same time, I think the sonnets have remained remarkably resistant to our usual strategies for discussing what happens to us when we read. And I wonder if that's because at the heart of the reading experience that they imagine, and I'll talk about that in a second, is a kind of possession or a kind of enthusiasm, which doesn't look especially useful and it doesn't look especially delightful either. So those of you who know Shakespeare's sonnets, who does know Shakespeare's sonnets? By the way, just put your hand up. Sonnets. Okay, that's good. So those of you who know the sonnets already will know that it's a dazzling, dazzling sequence, which explores how it feels to passionately love another person. The sonnets delve with an unflinching gaze into the most intimate and most unspeakable, sometimes, aspects of emotional experience. So Shakespeare writes about some of the most fundamental aspects of life, youth, age, sex, love, death, with a voice which is quite remarkable for its candour and its savage wit. The sequence contains, as many of you know, powerful poems which articulate the jealousy, self-pity, resentment, grief, despair, and occasional joy, and it's only occasional, which accompany the experience of desire. And in this way, their subject matter, I suppose, is essentially private. They're all about emotion, really. And they reveal the emotional self as an urgent subject for poetry, an incredibly capacious and wide-ranging subject for poetry. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to talk about some sonnets in some detail. But what I want to do really is to suggest to you that as much as the sonnets are about emotion, they're also sonnets about reading and writing poetry. So they theorise not just how it feels to experience powerful emotion, but also how it feels to read about powerful emotion and what's at stake when we do. So the first 126 sonnets in particular are addressed to a young man whose identity has never been determined, and they offer a series of explorations of love, but also a series of explorations of the act of reading and writing about love. And I think Shakespeare imagines the two things as inseparable, really, loving and reading about loving. But interestingly, the sonnets don't always involve a sort of regulation of the self or a mastery of the self, as Horace perhaps suggests, but rather a scattering of the self, a fragmenting of the self, something like what Delia Bacon experienced. So as Shakespeare knew, and as Delia Bacon described, losing ourselves in an experience of reading sometimes involves the experience of recognition, of sympathy, as the works that we read resonate in important ways with our own lives. And as we'll see, this raises quite fundamental questions, I think, about our own emotional and ethical responses to literary texts. And for me, that's the most exciting thing about this recent trend that Richard was talking about in literary studies, and actually in all kinds of studies in the humanities, towards the emotions. Because I think that the major sort of challenge or opportunity that it offers to us as readers and as professional readers is to think about literature as something living, something present. So not something that's confined to the past, not something that's confined to the archives, but rather to think about the literature of the past as remaining alive and remaining urgent and remaining important because it's capable of impacting upon us and transforming our own emotional lives. Okay, so let me backtrack for a little bit. So I've said that I want to talk about how the sonnets inspire us towards experiences of sympathy experiences of emotion and sympathy in particular. So the question then perhaps is, well, what sort of sympathy might we have for a sonneteer? Why might you expect to feel sympathy when you read a sonnet? Well, Shakespeare's early comedy, The Two Gentlemen of Verona, allows us to answer that question, I think. It was written before most of the sonnets, but it's a play all about a love triangle, a bit like the sonnets, actually. There's more than one love triangle in the sonnets, but the love triangle is at the very heart of The two Gentlemen of Verona. So the play tells the story of two friends, Proteus and Valentine, who become rivals for the love of one woman, Sylvia. Proteus turns out to be a terrible love rat who's deceitful and unfaithful, but he knows how to turn a sonnet. He's a great sonneteer. So as far as he's concerned, poetry is at the heart of courtship. If you're trying to woo a woman, then the first thing you've got to learn how to do is to write a sonnet. This is what he says. You must lay lime to tangle her desires by wailful sonnets whose composed rhymes should be fool fraught with serviceable vows. So in the first line there, the lime is bird lime, which is a sort of sticky substance that was used to trap birds in the 16th and 17th century. You'd sort of spread it along a branch and poor birds' feet would get stuck in the branch. So you can see how, for Proteus, sonnets work in sort of a similar way. They ensnare the beloved into submission. They get their feet stuck in the sonnet, as it were, and can't escape. So the best sonnets are wailful. They're a place for a lover to weep and wail, expressing a sort of hyperbolic grief without necessarily meaning it. That's very important. So such rhymes are fool fraught there in the third line, the product of a hard day at the desk spent rhyming, and the vows that they make are serviceable. In other words, they'll do the job of wooing. So Does that give you a hint to what sort of sympathy you might expect, or what a sonneteer might expect you to feel for their poem? That's the sort of sympathy. It's a kind of pity, a pity for this and this fool fraught, this wailful sonnet. And it's certainly true that some of the more self-pitying sonnets of Shakespeare's, and there are quite a few, I think, that are self-pitying, are full of bids for exactly this sort of sympathy. So the speaker keeps saying to the beloved that, for example, oh, you must forget me, you must forget me, even though the act of writing a sonnet works in exactly the opposite direction. You write a sonnet to be remembered, don't you, rather than to be forgotten. So let me give you an example. So I'm going to get to the sonnets at last now. So this is Sonnet 71. So this, I think, for me, is one of the most self-pitying of Shakespeare's sonnets. This is a real bid for sympathy. See if you agree. I'm going to read the whole thing. No longer mourn for me when I am dead, then you shall hear the surly, sullen bell give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world with vilest worms to dwell. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it, for I love you so that I, in your sweet thoughts, would be forgot, if thinking on me then should make you woe. Oh, if I say you look upon this verse when I, perhaps, compounded am with clay, do not so much as my poor name rehearse, but let your love even with my life decay. Lest the wise world should look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. So the strange thing about this sonnet, the real achievement of this sonnet, it's a wonderful sonnet, I think, but its real achievement is the paradox at its heart. It's a demand to be forgotten, isn't it? It's a very assertive, very noisy demand, saying, forget me, forget me, forget me. Even the speaker's poor name isn't worth mentioning, because even the mere mention of his name, would cause sorrow to the lover left behind. But look again at lines 5 and 6 there, one of the places where the sonnet imagines itself being read. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it. Well, that's hard to do, isn't it, when you're reading a love poem? Don't think about who wrote it. And think about all the first-person statements in this sonnet. Did you notice how many times the sonneteer mentions himself? When I am dead, that I am fled. I love you so, I in your sweet thoughts, thinking on me, I say my poor name, I am gone. So like many sonnets, reading this one involves reading about the speaker. It involves reading about the sonneteer, doesn't it? Rather than reading about the beloved, who it seems to be about. It's actually all about the sonneteer. And when the final couplet comes along, it's often the couplet that has the real sting in the tail with these sonnets. And this one, I think, is particularly stinging. It acts as a sort of grim warning, I think, or a challenge. Forget all about me, the speaker warns, lest the wise world should look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. Okay, so if you make the mistake of even mentioning me, the whole world will mock you just as they mock me in death. So his poor name may not be worth mourning, but at the same time, his voice is noisy enough to make any such forgetfulness impossible. So if it's a bid for sympathy, as I think it is, it's a strange sort of a bid, because there's something really threatening about the tone of this poem, really disturbing about the tone of this poem, which demands to be read sympathetically. It demands that you pity him. And yet at the same time, the poem forbids you to do precisely this. If you've ever looked for a poem to put in a Valentine's card, by the way, we probably should be, right? Not long till Valentine's Day. Don't start with Shakespeare's sonnets. There's not a single sonnet in there that will do for your Valentine's card. Or if you think it does, then you've missed the horrible sting in the tail in the couplet. There's something obscene or something unpleasant hidden between the lines. But part of what's so appealing about the sonnets, of course, this one included, is their apparent emotional candour. They seem incredibly frank, don't they? You get a taste of that, I think, even just from reading one. They look spontaneous. They look confessional. They look as though they come straight from Shakespeare's own psyche, his own self, his own heart. And of course, that's incredibly seductive to a Shakespearean, or indeed any of us interested in Shakespeare, because we know so very little about his biography. So the first person confessional tone of the sonnets seems to give unfettered access into the elusive territory of Shakespeare's consciousness. And it's surely true that the emotional turmoil they evoke with such clarity could hardly have been imagined by someone who hadn't experienced what he describes. These uniquely passionate sonnets have indeed often evoked uniquely impassioned responses from their readers. And they've always had this ability, I think, to build sympathies of various kinds with their readers. Perhaps most famously, the obsessive scholar Cyril Graham, who I think I mentioned in my little abstract for this talk, who, as you might remember if you know Oscar Wilde's The Portrait of Mr. W.H., shoots himself with a revolver in order to demonstrate his firm and flawless belief, as he calls it, that the dedicatee of the volume of sonnets, Mr. W.H., was in fact the beautiful young Elizabethan actor Willie Hughes. Of course, we don't know who the dedicatee of the sonnets is. It's a very riddling title page which dedicates the poems to Mr. W.H., and we'll never know, I expect, who that is. But Wilde's story reminds us, I think, of the sonnet's extraordinary ability to beguile us, to entrance us, to possess those who read them. And they know that they're doing it. So the history of the sonnets have been read, I suggest, is in fact as passionate or as impassioned as the sonnets themselves. So that's all very good, it's all very, very interesting. But at the same time, Lytton Strachey wrote in 1905, the sonnets lure the unwary traveller at every turn into paths already white with the bones of innumerable commentators. So there's a sort of track that the sonnets have left in their wake of bones of people who have misread them or misunderstood them or have thought that they've understood them, have thought that they found the key to Shakespeare's heart through reading the sonnets. But it's worth remembering, I think, that the private affairs that the sonnets allude to are impossible really to guess at. And of course that as a dramatist, Shakespeare was an expert ventriloquist. So he was thoroughly expert at assuming the voice of another person. And the sonnets, I think, are no exception. So no matter how confessional they look, no matter how direct the access that they seem to provide to Shakespeare's emotional life, that confession can be a rhetorical construction. It can be a piece of fiction. As Sasha Roberts writes, the sonnets perhaps bear testament to their author's skillful creation of the effect of eavesdropping on a heady, passionate and painful affair. But it's an effect, not necessarily the real thing. Because, of course, despite their appearance of spontaneity, sonnets are actually a really, really artful, very highly exacting and remarkably compressed form, made up of those familiar 14 lines. So you have the three quatrains, three groups of four lines, one after another, followed by the couplet, the two lines at the very end. And thanks to the demands posed by this inflexible form, sonnets, including Shakespeare's, are often astonishingly composed. So they're really intricately, carefully put together. You take one word out and the whole sonnet falls apart. And they're always, I think, very self-conscious about the way they express feeling. So it's exactly this tension, in fact, between spontaneity, what comes naturally, what looks like emotional truth-telling, and contrivance, what's artful, what's carefully put together, which actually animates Shakespeare's sonnets. It's the way these two things pull against one another, I think, that appearance of spontaneity and authenticity and the demands posed by this really artful, carefully constructed form. It's worth remembering, too, that by the time Shakespeare's volume of sonnets was published in 1609, Sonnets had been going for quite a while. Sonnet sequences had developed by this time into a powerful vehicle for exploring the psyche, articulating inward experience, and capturing the cadences of emotional turbulence. So many sonnet sequences were published in the 1590s, some time before Shakespeare's were published in 1609, starting with Sidney's Astrophel and Stella, written in 1586, published in 1591, and 19 collections of love poems and sonnets were published just in the 7 years after that. So there's this huge flowering, this amazing moment, really, in the history of English literature, when all of a sudden people were writing sonnets and people were reading sonnets. But that was all happening in the 1590s. So the interesting question is, well, what happens by 1609? What can you do with the sonnet form in 1609? Because you can reflect, you can think back to what others have done with it, and you can reflect creatively, perhaps, on the sonnet form and think differently or think satirically about what it's for. Well, even if you've read all of these sonnet sequences of the 1590s, you could hardly be prepared, I think, for encountering Shakespeare's, for their sheer virtuosity and their sheer intensity. And if they're not formally experimental, which they're not, Shakespeare's sonnets don't experiment with this really rigid, formal structure of the sonnet, they are experimental, I think, in the way that they imagine these bonds of sympathy with their readers. So we looked a moment ago at the two gentlemen of Verona and at Proteus's bid for pity or sympathy with his wailful sonnets to Sylvia. And we looked at Sonnet 71, which makes the same sort of appeal, perhaps, for pity, although it's a much more complicated, much more sort of rhetorically sophisticated one. But what I'm really interested in the sonnets is a different sort of sympathy altogether, really, which emerges slowly but surely in the sequence. The familiar meaning of sympathy, the sort of sympathy that Proteus is looking for, is a kind of pity or a kind of compassion which we might feel towards somebody else. Pity that inclines us to spare or to succour, as the Oxford English Dictionary puts it. But until the mid-1600s, though, sympathy or compassion retained a quite different meaning. And that was the meaning of suffering with somebody else, so not necessarily feeling pity for somebody else, as though you're detached or separate from them, but feeling pity or sympathy with someone else, participation in suffering or fellow feeling. So you could be moved to pity without necessarily sharing somebody's grief or sharing somebody's sorrow. Sympathy in this less familiar sense involves participating in the very emotion that one witnesses. So according to this meaning of the word, then, whatever passion you witness, whatever it is that you're reading about, say, in a sonnet, anger, despair, resentment, humiliation, indignation, a compassionate or a sympathetic response is one which sympathetically shares that feeling. So that's quite an interesting thought, I suppose, as a reader of a sonnet. What would it mean to read sympathetically if you share the emotion described? Well, in fact, a lot of theorists writing in the late 16th century were trying to get their heads around exactly that idea, I think. I want to read you a quotation from a theorist called George Puttenham, who wrote a book called The Art of English Poesy in 1579. So Puttenham wrote a bit about how love poems, like sonnets, should engage the emotions of their readers. And Puttenham understood that the assimilation of good poetry, when it's redeployed in practices of reading and speaking, can profoundly affect the passions or the emotions, and through them it can affect the moral self or the spiritual self. So according to Puttenham, then, Poetry allows the many moods and pangs of lovers thoroughly to be discovered. The poor souls sometimes praying, beseeching, sometimes honouring, advancing, praising, another while railing, reviling and cursing, then sorrowing, weeping, lamenting, in the end laughing, rejoicing and solacing the beloved again, moving one way and another to great compassion. This is quite a good description of the sonnets, actually, the emotional roller coaster that the sequence takes you on from start to finish. But what's really interesting, I think, about this is that Puttenham describes poems about love not just through their content, but through the emotions that they arouse in those who encounter them. Perhaps the beloved, who's addressed by the poems, or perhaps us, their readers. So just as the lover's emotions swing between longing, ambition, frustration, anger, and so on, so the emotions of the reader are moved one way and another through compassion. And for Puttenham, poetry is perhaps all about that exchange of emotions that takes place between writer and reader. That's where the poem happens. It doesn't happen so much on the page. It happens in this this energetic exchange of feeling between a reader and an author. Another theorist of poetry, Sir Philip Sidney, wrote something similar in his book, An Apology for Poetry, published in 1595. So Sidney writes that any poet able faithfully to paint suffering is to be praised either for compassionate, that word again, compassionate accompanying just causes of lamentations, or for rightly painting out how weak